Well, good afternoon. I'm Randy Hewlett. We have new results on the collapse of a Bose-Einstein condensate that I'm going to be concentrating on here in this talk. I'd like to acknowledge the people that have contributed to this work, and in particular, to the people who have contributed to the collapse experiment. And these would be Cass Sackett, present group member, Jordan Gerton, Curtis Bradley. And we've been very fortunate over the years to have a fruitful collaboration with the group of Hank Stoph, which includes Mariana Hubiers, who's here today and will be giving a talk on Thursday on lithium-6. All right, well, this may be preaching to the choir, but in case there's a few non-believers in the audience, what are the interests in trapped atom condensates? Well, most of that goes back, most of the interest can be derived from the fact that these are very low density gases, and therefore interactions can be treated as weak perturbations. Furthermore, the interaction strength and the sign can be varied by controlling things like the density, the atomic species, fields, magnetic fields, and perhaps electric fields, as I've heard today. Internal states, the particular hyperfine state that the system is in. We can trap multiple species, we can trap bosons, we can trap fermions, combinations of those. And the systems are easily probed optically, and so that we can measure things like density distributions, number, temperature, condensate fraction, normal mode spectrum, and dynamics. And furthermore, the systems are fairly long-lived. We can study them for periods of up to tens of seconds. So the interactions, one of the most beautiful aspects of these systems is the fact that the interactions are so weak, the gases are so dilute, that you can study the potentials, you can consider the potentials only pairwise. You only have to consider two bodies interacting at a time, and you can ignore usually three body effects and certainly higher order effects. Furthermore, the range of the potential, the range of this interaction potential being on the order of a nanometer is much smaller than the characteristic de Broglie wavelengths in these experiments, which is kind of on the order of microns. And so consequently, the exact shape of the potential isn't very important, and rather we can represent the interaction by a single parameter, the S-wave scattering length. The S-wave scattering length is related to the elastic scattering cross-section by A squared, and it's also related to the mean field interaction energy by the density times the scattering length. Now, all the theories that I know about, maybe not all, but I think it's fair to say that essentially all the theoretical treatments in this field have used a mean field interaction in which they model the condensate by a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, also known as the Gross-Pitovsky equation. It has terms representing the kinetic energy, the interaction energy, and also the effect of the potential, the external potential in the atoms. Now, there are two cases for these interactions. Either the scattering length can be negative, corresponding to attractive interactions in this term, or the scattering length can be positive, corresponding to repulsive interactions. Now, I promised Bill that I would provide one view graph and one only on scattering lengths, and this is it. This is mostly to acknowledge the work of my former student, Eric Abraham, who has completely determined all the scattering lengths in lithium to very high precision. These are recently published in PhysRev A, in this reference, a summary, which I've given here. These are both the singlet and the triplet scattering lengths for the two isotopes, the two stable isotopes of lithium, lithium-6, which is a fermion, and lithium-7, which is a boson, and also the mixed case, which is interesting for sympathetic cooling and perhaps for other reasons as well. But the two numbers that I most like to draw your attention to are the triplet scattering lengths for lithium-6, which is negative and extremely large. And that means that the interactions are effectively attractive, but also very big in magnitude. In lithium-7, that means that Mariana will talk about this on Thursday, that there's a possibility of seeing a BCS phase transition of lithium-6. And lithium-7, it's also negative. It's much smaller in magnitude. But the minus sign means that the interactions are effectively attractive. I'd also like to point out that the precision that we've been able to realize in this column is due to the fact that we've developed a two-photon spectroscopic technique to directly probe the ground state bound levels in the diatomic molecule. So what are the implications of the scattering length or BEC? Well, if A is positive, it means, as it is for sodium and rubidium, it means that the condensate can be stable. It also means that the properties, the thermodynamic properties, the critical temperature, the excitation spectrum, and so forth, can be related to an ideal gas by a perturbation series expansion. In the case of negative scattering length, for example, lithium, the situation is really very different because the interaction potential is negative, and it's in particular its derivative with respect to density is negative. It means the condensate's unstable to collapse. That means it would rather be in a more dense state in order to minimize its energy. And that was thought to prevent BEC in a gas altogether, and that was first, I think, made explicit by Landau and Lifshitz in their book in 1958, and was reiterated most recently by Stope in 1994. But in a trap, the situation is really different. The kinetic energy can help stabilize the gas because the derivative of the kinetic energy term with respect to density is positive. And that means that you can have a metastable condensate as long as the number of condensate atoms is small enough. And for our atom and our trap, small enough is about 1,200 atoms. That idea can be made more concrete and to advantage using a variational calculation. This is after Stove, but other people have done this as well. If you use this as a variational wave function, the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, with the parameter Q being the variational parameter, you can write down the contributions to the three terms of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, the kinetic energy term, the interaction term, and the harmonic potential. Plot them. That's what I've done here. The green is the kinetic energy, the red is the external confinement, and the blue is due to the attractive interactions. And you can see that their combination for this number of atoms, their combination given in black, has a metastable potential well. And that potential well, the condensate can exist in this potential well because there's this barrier for it to go into the more dense state. That barrier exists as long as the number of lithium atoms is less than about 1,200. As you put more and more atoms into the condensate, this term begins to dominate, and it pulls down this well further and further until you get to N naught max, about 1,200 in our case. There's no well at all, and the barrier completely disappears. How do we make condensates? Well, we use a trap, a magnetic trap, which consists of permanent magnets. These are 6 neodymium iron boron magnets arranged in such a way as to provide a harmonic restoring potential and a bias field of about 1,000 Gauss. Now, this potential is very spherically symmetric. The axial frequencies and the radial frequencies are almost the same, which turns out to be a really good property for us because the maximum number of atoms that you can have in the condensate is related to the smallest dimension. And so in order to maximize for a given number, in order to maximize the density, you want to have a spherically symmetric trap. The other nice feature about the trap is that because it's made of permanent magnets, it's very stable. The field stability is about a part in 10 of the 6, maybe a little bit better. Now, given this trap potential and given the mass of the lithium atom, that corresponds to a condensate radius of about 3 microns. OK, okay, we load the trap using laser cooling. We're able to load from a laser-slowed atomic beam about 5 × 10⁸ atoms per second and cool them to about 200 microkelvin. And then we use evaporative cooling. This stage takes about 1 second. This stage takes about 2 or 3 minutes to eject the hottest atoms using the microwave spin flip technique. And we're able to produce a Bose-Einstein condensate with about 1 million total atoms at a temperature of about 700 nanokelvin. Our first data, our first evidence for condensation lithium was reported in 1995, about 1 month after the Jilla experiment. How do we see what we have? Well, we use an imaging technique. We've developed a polarization phase contrast technique to be able to image the distribution. What we do is we send in a probe laser beam, which is tuned several hundred megahertz away from the resonance. So the idea is to interact with the index of refraction of the atoms rather than its absorption coefficient. So the scattered light, the light which is coherently scattered by the atom cloud, is recombined using some imaging lenses onto an image plane and then magnified using a microscope objective and then imaged onto a CCD array camera. So the signal here is proportional to the phase of the atoms, the real part of the index of refraction, and it's proportional then to the column density of the atom cloud. It's an integral of the density along the direction of the laser beam. So the image that we record here gives us a distribution, a spatial profile that depends on the transverse dimensions of the cloud. We can fit that signal to Bose-Einstein statistics to find the condensate number, the total number, and the temperature of the distribution. So here's an example of this happens to be an absorption measurement, but it gives you basically the same idea. This is the laser beam here, the bigger radius. And in the middle, you see a little dark cloud. That's basically the shadow that the atoms cast on this laser beam. So we can do some image subtraction and look at just the atom cloud itself. You can see it's a little bit asymmetric, which corresponds to the asymmetry of the trap frequencies, which is about 1.15 to 1. You can then take a cut through this distribution, and you can plot it, and you get the results that look like the thing on the bottom here. So we've done this in situ, I might add, because we can't release the atoms from the trap. We have to image the atoms while they're in the trap. And so we have to be able to detect, in order to see the condensate or see the whole distribution, we have to be able to resolve something that's as small as 3 microns. So this data here shows that resolution of the condensate. These are 4 different data sets. The data is indicated by open circles. On the top is a data set which is fit. The red line is a fit to Bose-Einstein statistics. It's a fit which produces about 90,000 atoms at about 300 nanokelvin. And it's basically non-degenerate. It's a fit with T above TC. And you can see that by comparing to a Maxwell-Boltzmann classical distribution, which is shown in black. And they're very similar. Now, the 3 data sets below that are all data sets that show the presence of a condensate. And probably the most striking one is the first one because it has only 10% more atoms than the one above it, basically at the same temperature, but now the fit is to about 500 condensate atoms, and you can see how distinctly different the Bose-Einstein fit is from the classical fit. So we can, because of the resolution that we have, we can quite readily determine, resolve on the order of 100 atoms. So the other distributions are for colder clouds and producing various total numbers and temperatures, but all with condensate numbers, which is less than this 1,200 atom number. This is an indication of our sensitivity to condensate number. It's a plot of chi-squared versus condensate number for a particular distribution. And you can see that chi-squared goes up by about a factor of 2 for plus or minus 100 condensate atoms. We also have a systematic uncertainty of about 100 to 200 atoms as well. So our results for that experiment are that the number of condensate atoms in all cases, even up to 10 to the fifth total numbers of atoms in the distribution, in all cases the condensate number is always, the maximum is somewhere between 1,000 and 1,300. And so we're very confident then that the mean field theory prediction is consistent with our measurements. So this, I think, is another consistency check on the, among others, on the mean field validity. Now, the condensate collapses, it's predicted to collapse when the condensate number approaches this N0 max of this number of 1,250. But in fact, the collapse can be initiated even for condensate numbers below N0 max. And you can see that again from looking at this variational calculation, that this barrier can be tunneled through, or it can also be thermally fluctuated over. And so even though that the number is a number less than 1,250, the collapse, there's going to be some rate for collapse given by macroscopic quantum tunneling through the barrier or thermal activation over the top of it. A third mechanism that, to my knowledge, hasn't been treated theoretically, the first two have, by Stoff and Kagan and recently by Tony Leggett and Ueda and others. A third mechanism I don't think has been treated theoretically is that there are fluctuations, of course. This is a microcanonical ensemble, and there are fluctuations in the occupation number. I don't think that that's been included in any of the theories up till now, and it could, in fact, be important. But an important point to be made here is that condensate atoms are lost during the collapse, because as the collapse occurs, the condensate becomes more dense. And as the density goes up, the rate for inelastic collisions, two-body dipolar decay and three-body recombination, become larger. And because of that, this rate suddenly blows up, and those atoms, as they are condensing, very rapidly are lost from the trap. This has been treated theoretically by Stoff and Kagan and his collaborators. Now, in the collapse itself, the dynamics of the collapse is very interesting, and it's very interesting how to include losses, these two-body and three-body losses, into the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. There have been two papers on the subject, one by Stoff and us, where Stoff treats the losses, these two-body and three-body losses, in a global way. He says that he treats the nonlinear Schrodinger equation thusly, and he says that atoms are lost, these condensate atoms are lost due to some kind of a density-dependent decay rate. And it's a global loss, so that if a condensate atom is lost, the whole condensate wave function amplitude is diminished, so that the loss is over the entire condensate. Now, Kagan and his collaborators have treated the losses differently. They treat them in terms of an imaginary term in the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. This is the two-body and this is the three-body. So this is more of a local treatment of the losses. And they get some very interesting effects. They find that there's some very interesting dynamics. As the condensate begins to collapse in their model, the rate for three-body recombination becomes so great that the collapse self-arrests due to the loss of so many of the atoms and begins to inflate again. And so so there's some interesting hydrodynamic reflections and it blows out and then it comes back in again. It blows out and it comes back in. So there's some very interesting dynamics that come out of that model. The main point I want to make about the differences is that in Stoff's model, all atoms are lost from the condensate during the collapse, whereas in the Kagan model, approximately 50% of the atoms are predicted to remain. And so that's the main difference in the prediction. Now, just as an aside, I should say that the nonlinear Schrodinger equation has been used to describe many wave collapse phenomena. It's been used to treat the self-focusing of nonlinear media, of optical waves in nonlinear media, and Langmuir wave collapses in plasmas. And this was has been, over the many years, has been discussed extensively by Zakharov and his colleagues. Okay. These loss rates, especially the two-body loss rate, can be calculated very reliably. It's a two-body mechanism, and people like Verhaar can calculate the dipolar loss very accurately, and people are very confident of that. The three-body loss rate is a completely different matter, and there, even Verhaar calculates three-body losses, but even Verhaar will concede that they're accurate maybe to an order of magnitude, and so we really don't know what those rates are, unless they can be measured. And they have been measured in both the Gila group and MIT have measured three-body loss rates. Yes? Okay. Is he still a factor of 10 off? Okay. Well, I suspect that has something to do with the near cancellation of the phase shifts, the scattering lengths in rubidium, which is kind of an anomalous case. So the scattering rubidium is... Okay. Well, we should talk about that. Because my impression was from talking to Verhaar that the dipolar rates are really well... He seems very confident of this. But in any case, that's his thing. We've done, in particular, my student Cass Sackett has calculated using a quantum Boltzmann equation the dynamics of the total number and the condensate number of atoms in the trap during evaporation. So the top part of this figure shows the total number during evaporation in red. And we're starting here in the simulation with about 10 to the fifth atoms. This is versus time. And during evaporation, the number of atoms is slowly being decreased because we're kicking those atoms out. And on the bottom, simultaneously, is plotted the number of condensate atoms versus time. So during evaporative cooling, you can see that at the outset, there are no condensate atoms because the gas is still above TC. Eventually, you hit the critical temperature, and the condensate begins to grow. And it grows up to approximately this N0 max number. And where exactly it collapses is random. It's stochastic. It's given by the rates for these the macroscopic quantum tunneling and these thermal activation rates. But approximately at 1,200 atoms, it decays. And according to Stokes' model, it decays all the way down to zero condensate atoms, and then it grows again as we're continuing to evaporatively cool. So there are very many more atoms up in here in the non-condensed cloud than there are in the condensate itself. And so we see a cyclic behavior that the condensate grows and it collapses. It grows again and it collapses. It keeps going. This process continues until all the condensate atoms are gone. Now, no, we haven't, and I'll explain that in a minute, the difficulties in seeing that behavior. In Kagan's model, the behavior is very similar. They also see this growth and collapse, but the result of the collapse is a little bit different. That in Stokes' model, the collapse is complete, and in Kagan's model, the collapse is only to about 50% of N0 max, so about 600, then grows and collapses and grows and collapses. And again, there's some interesting dynamical compression and expansion behavior that goes on here. Yeah? I believe it's the way the losses are treated. The Stokes model is treating the losses globally, and Kagan's model is treating them with this imaginary term in the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. I believe that maybe Yuri could comment on that, but I believe that that's the main difference. So what we expect, or what the simple model is predicting, is that the condensate, whoop, not very much contrast there. Yeah, it's better. So the condensate grows out of this thermal cloud. You can see here there are about 20,000 atoms in the non-condensed cloud. It begins to grow. Here's the case where there's about 50 condensate atoms. It then grows to about 600, continues to grow until N naught is about equal to N naught max, about 1,200, and then it suddenly collapses. And the collapse in this very simple treatment, the collapse doesn't affect the non-condensed atoms. Now, I think in a real treatment, in a complete theory, that you would want to take into account the effect that this collapse had on the rest of the cloud. Obviously, there's a very violent action that's going to have some effect, the very non-equilibrium result that's going to have some effect on the rest of the cloud. And the question is how big that effect should be. It's a picture. It's a simulation. Yeah. Okay, here's the expected distribution for the same simulation. Again, we're assuming that the collapse is complete. This is, before I get to that, let me answer your question, Hartmoon, about how to see this behavior. Obviously, the neatest way to see this behavior would be to non-destructively image the same cloud. If you could non-destructively image the condensate and see it grow and collapse and grow and collapse, that would be the best way of seeing the effect. Well, it turns out that the signal-to-noise requirements to be able to detect something with the kind of sensitivity...
Due to feeling, you explain, because it's difficult to understand. Is it due to feeling?
Yes, yes, yes. This growth is due to the evaporative cooling. And so it's being the growth is driven by the cooling of the cloud, of the thermal cloud. The best way, of course, to be able to see this, to be able to non-destructively image it, the signal-to-noise requirements are much too severe to be able to have the sensitivity of a few hundred atoms. And so instead, what we're doing is statistically analyzing the pictures that we get by repeatedly going to one point in this evaporative cooling cycle and measuring the number of condensate atoms. So we go, for example, to this point, we take a picture, we see how many condensate atoms are in this distribution, and we do that over and over again. And if this collapse fill model is correct, then we expect to see a distribution of condensate atoms that goes from essentially zero, if Stokes' model is correct, to the maximum number, which is about 1,250. So this is indicated here. This is the expected distribution from this quantum Boltzmann equation. This is the probability of detecting a certain condensate number. It's relatively flat once you get above about 100, and then it drops off very rapidly. This larger peak for low condensate numbers is, in fact, very interesting, and that's due to the fact that they're the Bose enhancement of the growth of the condensate is taking over at larger numbers. And so the growth initially is rather slower than it later becomes. And you can see that here. There's a little bit of curvature as the growth starts out slowly and then eventually takes off. And that gives you this enhanced peak at low numbers. This is what we see experimentally. This is for about 20,000 atoms total. We see something which is indeed very consistent with this growth collapse model. That is, we see a fluctuation or a distribution of condensate numbers that ranges essentially from something between 0 and 150 up to a maximum number of somewhere around 1,200. The distribution isn't quite as flat as the simple model would predict. And interestingly, the big peak at the low condensate numbers isn't there. And we take this as an indication that the collapse isn't complete, that it doesn't go to zero condensate atoms, that it goes to something which would be approximately 100 atoms. And so we don't see this large enhancement of low numbers that one would expect for the condensate to be slowly growing. So we see these fluctuations in condensate number, and we've looked for correlations with other things in our experiment, the total number of atoms in the cloud, its temperature, the time in the evaporative cooling cycle, probe parameters such as detuning and intensity, and the goodness of fit. And I can show some of those correlations here, actually the lack of correlations. We see no correlations with any of those effects. The top is correlations of condensate number with total number. And you can see there's basically a complete uniformity. And on the bottom is a test of the condensate number versus goodness of fit. And again, you can see that there's essentially no correlations evident. So we do believe that we're seeing what we think we're seeing, that we're seeing the distribution of condensate number, which is due to this growth and collapse. It supports the collapse fill model. Most of the atoms seem to be ejected during the collapse, but not all. So in that sense, I would say that that Hank is right in that the condensate, the collapse is nearly complete. But in the other sense, I would say that Yuri, you're right in that the collapse seems to go to some non-zero number. How's that for political correctness? Nobody is wrong. The collapse seems to be to something which is on the order of 100 atoms. So I'd like to point out that this is evidence for a macroscopic quantum behavior. There are two macroscopic quantum events involved in this process. One is the macroscopic quantum tunneling in the energy barrier, and the other is the collective thermal decay mode. In the future, we intend to induce the collapse. There's two ways that we're thinking of doing that. One is to try to drive the breathing mode of the condensate oscillation. If the breathing mode, this is essentially the mode in which the thermal energy couples to the condensate and causes it to collapse. If we can drive it by applying an oscillating magnetic field at the frequency at which it collapses, we should be able to induce it. The frequency of the breathing mode, in fact, varies with condensate number. And so as if we look at the spectrum of the magnetic field the condensate numbers versus the magnetic field frequency, we should be able to map out this curve, which would be a measurement of the breathing mode of the condensate. You can see that the breathing mode frequency goes soft as the critical numbers approach. And in fact, right at the critical number, at the maximum number, the breathing mode frequency goes to zero, indicative of the well going away. And the second way that we're would like to investigate for initiating the collapse is by a suggestion of Fedichev, Kagan, Shliapnikov, and Walravin a couple of years ago, in which they suggested that the scattering length could be changed by tuning a laser beam, basically a photoassociation laser beam, to near a molecular resonance in the excited diatomic molecule. Not right on resonance, but near it. And they've shown that you can get fairly large changes in the scattering length without significant light scattering that would destroy the condensate. What we think that we can do is that we can make the change enough negative to drive the collapse, to make it happen at the instant that we flash the light on. And that could be very interesting because we could then study the dynamics of the condensate itself. As the condensate is collapsing, if we can trigger it, then we can watch it during the millisecond or so that it takes for it to collapse. The second thing that we're thinking about and working on is to make a double condensate with another hyperfine level that also interacts via the triplet scattering length, so that we would have two independent condensates, both of the same interaction energy. And the question then theoretically is, how is the maximum number in this double condensate related to the single condensate case? That's it. Thank you. It's a trade-off. It's a question of how rapidly the density is increasing and how large the inelastic decay rates are. And you can imagine if the inelastic decay rates are very large, the density is increasing by several orders of magnitude and everything very quickly goes away.
Are the calculations of decay rates based on the assumption that even after the collapse, the atoms are still moving essentially as slowly as they were originally, or do they take into account the effect that they were being considerably accelerated during the collapse?
So are you asking whether the effect on the inelastic decay rates includes energy? No, it doesn't. Not quite. It's that the mean field energy is negative, which makes it mechanically unstable. On a microscopic level, something happens, and that something is two-body and three-body inelastic decay rates.
Inelastic processes is starting to be very strong before it will be transition to any it's happening when there is a gate parameters work.
The non-condensed atoms, interaction energy of the non-condensed atoms is very small, much, much less than the temperature. No. No, you don't need the losses to get the collapse. And so if you were to take away the losses and you were to look at the solutions of that nonlinear Schrodinger equation, you would find that if N naught were close to N naught max, that you would have some tunneling or thermal activation that would cause the collapse. That's independent of losses. The losses only tell you what's going to happen during the collapse. And that during the collapse that is what is where the three-body recombination of the dipole are.
I would like to describe very shortly what is the mechanism is really exists. You can imagine that when you have so large number of the atoms, it's possible to have limited number in the condensate only if you are very close to temperature transition. And it's additional question, if there is possibility to have such a closeness experimentally to have equilibrium number less than 1,000 or something like that. In reality, you always count some down, and just now the situation is the following. There is, if it will be no interaction, it will be large number particle in condensate. Large number, essentially more than 1,000. What is now going on? There is a ceiling till you have approximately critical one. Nothing to do with tunneling. Of course, we discussed, maybe you remember, we discussed that it will be tunneling phenomena, but it's suppressed very severely. And there is a situation when number of the particles started more than critical already in condensate. It started now the motion of collapsing. And during the collapsing, you have increase of density and strong increase of density. Then you have very strong burst of inelastic processes. And immediately you have the motion coming out, and it started waiting when another particle fell again above the critical one. So the fact that it's just now in condensate, we have the finite number of the particles, not zero, is just due to the fact that the burning of the condensate has no time because there is the expansion, there is expansion after the collapse. So it's always, of course, it will be something statistically. You cannot tell exactly that it will be half. But we have seen in direct calculation, we calculated on a level of Gross-Pitayevsky by including ceiling and in
your time's up.
including ceiling and reaction. And just in this case, we have seen this such type of oscillation. Of course, it could be additional process, it will be more complicated, but nevertheless, I believe that there will be some finite number of particles in the after 5 days.
What?
I was just going to ask you, Randy, in these models, is it possible to predict, if you just went ahead and instead of stopping at some point in the evaporative cycle, if you just went through the whole cycle at different rates, is it possible to predict that there might be differences in the quantum compensate numbers based on the RFC?
Okay, well, that's a really interesting question. So you're saying if you were to drive the, depending on how far out of equilibrium you were to drive the distribution, you might see different effects.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the models work.
The models haven't gone that far. Okay. And there's certainly room theoretically to look at questions like that.
It sounds like an easy experiment. Like
it's it takes a long time to get that amount of data. But you're right, we could do it at a different temperature.
Can you remind us what is the rate of collapsing? It's just in, because the curve you showed seems to be absolutely intact, and the rate of collapsing and the feeling, and in terms of the elastic collision rate or the rate of the cycle.
Okay. The rate for filling is given by the rate for elastic collisions. And in our trap, that's about 1 per second is the elastic collision rate. And so the rate for filling is proportional to that. The rate for the collapse, if you're talking about the tunneling rates or the thermal rates, those are strongly and not dependent. And so, in fact, they're exponentially dependent. They're essentially zero, you know, 100 atoms below the maximum number, and they're, for all intents and purposes, infinite at the maximum number.
The time of collapse is the reciprocal frequency of the test. It will be when the number of the particles will be more than critical one. After that collapse is
I disagree a little bit with you there, Yuri. That depends on the rate for filling the condensate. And if the rate for filling the condensate is relatively slow, much slower than what you considered, then you can imagine that the number never gets above the maximum number. But if you're asking what the rate for the collapse is itself or the time scale, it's about a millisecond. Right. Right. It does build up quickly, but the numbers never get. I have a view graph on that. The numbers never get big enough for it to completely take off. But let me see if I have. No, I don't have that with me. I'll find it and show you later.
Carl, I was puzzled by that you were looking at the function of the number as a function of Luna's state.
Yeah.
And you give chi squared an arbitrary unit.
Right.
Chi squared is normally in
arbitrary. Yeah.
What is chi squared here?
It's just not normalized. We haven't we haven't, this data is very recent. We just haven't characterized the noise, this unnormalized chi-square. So it's a relative chi-square. You calculate what the deviation from the mean is.
Okay, so that's what you're...
Right. Right.
So if you haven't characterized that, that should give them, if you have a big range of fits, that should give you a big range of uncertainties also for the
It's completely proportional to that relative chi-square that I gave. The chi-squares on our fits are always rather good. Here's one where we have, where we give an absolute chi-squared, and you can see that it is essentially one, the minimum. It's normalized to one. So this is, the chi-squared is essentially one by your definition, at the minimum. Yeah, and that's because of noise in the data. Let me get that back. Right. Okay. So there's the range in chi-squared, and you can see that it's rather tight. It's within plus or minus. It's within a factor of two. Right. Right. Obviously, the important criterion is when the chi-squared doubles. And the chi-squared roughly doubles for a change of about 100 condensate atoms.
No. But the criteria isn't when the chi-squared doubles. The criteria, going from chi-squared 2 up to a chi-squared 4 means that you have some idea of what's going on. You have no idea whatsoever what's going on.
All right. Well, we know exactly what the chi-squared is. As I said, we just haven't characterized what the noise was in order to put absolute units on that axis. This is the quality of the fit. That's a typical fit. The thermal energy comes from the fact that these are not pure condensates. And so if you did have pure condensates, the only mechanism would be the macroscopic quantum tunneling. But because these are thermal distributions, the temperatures of around, about 200 nanokelvin, there's thermal energy in the cloud, and so that can be transmitted to the condensate to give it that excitation. I think you could basically look at it that way. I think it's an exchange of energy from the thermal atoms with the condensate, which I think is continually going on. There's continual exchange of condensate atoms with thermal atoms. And I think that exchange, that interaction, that collisional interaction, can impart thermal energy to the condensate, which can drive this thermal breathing mode.
Have these numbers,
our resolution isn't sufficient to say how close to the critical number that the collapse occurs. Their uncertainty is about plus or minus 100.
But all of that does not require additional energy. Could be the energy zero. Collapse is just a self-evolution. It's not. It doesn't require energy.
It was mentioned that the collapse could be possible even below the
Stoff has calculated the rates as a function of temperature, and they are significant at the temperatures that we're at.
One more question.
You showed on your theoretical curve that once the total number of atoms is below 1,000, they will not collapse anymore. What would happen if you would try to measure the statistics of the condensate number in that region? If the statistics in this region it would be different?
I guess I didn't understand that.
After a certain time, you yeah. Have
1,000
atoms left.
Right.
They cannot collapse anymore.
Right.
Now, if you would take repeated measurements at
right.
The time, would the distribution be different?
Okay. So you're asking if. We could.
During time of field, which is a very large in your case.
Okay. Let me. Quickly find that view graph. Yeah, no, it's not quite that. I think I have exactly. Okay, here it is. Okay, so if you wait long enough that the number of condensate atoms never it can never grow beyond the critical number. You could do an experiment where you went to this point repeatedly, and the question is then how repeatable is the loading conditions such that you know A, that you're beyond the collapse region, and B, you are still going to see a distribution of condensate numbers. It's going to have its maximum number suppressed, but you'll still see a distribution because you don't know the phase of these growth collapse cycles because of the stochastic nature of it. And so you don't know exactly, you won't be able to go to the same point every time.
So there would be a distribution, but is the theoretical distribution in that area different from the theoretical distribution in the area time?
Yeah, it would be different because you wouldn't see the higher numbers. The higher numbers would be suppressed. Now, we've taken data in that regime, and we do see that if we wait a long time, that we always get condensate numbers, which are small.
Okay, we will reassemble at 10 past 4.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.